Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japan Needs. I'm your host, Akiko Taima, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Providers in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is a mystery for many people, so I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Derek Wilcox, who studied Japanese kaiseki cuisine at the 3-star restaurant Kikunoi in Kyoto, and Edamame Sushi at the Ginza Sushi Aoki in Tokyo, also Michelin starred, for 10 years in total. He's now the chef at the Shoji at 69 Leonard Street in Tribeca, New York, and earned a precious 3-star rating from the New York Times last year. And many cooks aspire to study Japanese cuisine in Japan, but it is not easy because of language and cultural barriers, and among other things, I guess. So Derek's background is surprising and super refreshing. So today we'll find out how he conquered challenges of working at the traditional Japanese restaurants in Japan, and how he interprets Japanese food culture, how he expresses that idea on his menu at 69 Renard Street, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. Also, please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. And I have a quick announcement. The 24th Sumo Stew is coming to New York tomorrow on Monday, March 19th at 8 p.m. Oh, sorry, Tuesday. Tuesday, March 19th at 8 p.m. at Brooklyn Brewery in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And Wednesday, March 20th at 7 p.m. at Japan Society in Midtown, New York. And as you may know, Sumo Stew is a seasonal live streaming event of sumo matches straight from Japan. And you can enjoy Japanese food from outstanding restaurants as you watch the fun matches. And tickets available at eventbrite.com and search Sumo Stew, that's S-U-M-O-S-T-E-W, and you can find both events. So again, it's tomorrow on Tuesday, March 19th at Brooklyn Brewery, and Wednesday at Japan Society at 7 p.m. So, also for Japanese listeners, there is a 10% off discount code. That is Japan Eats, one word, Japan Eats. And on a checkout, you can just enter this code, Japan Eats, and you get a $10 off. So I hope to see you there. Now let's start a conversation with Derek Wilcox. Hello, Derek. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So I have so many questions because you're such an amazing, achieved figure. So first of all, where are you from? And what did you eat when you grew up?
I was born upstate New York, but I mostly grew up in Virginia. And I suppose I ate mostly the same things that most other American kids at that time were eating. A lot of SpaghettiOs, a lot of macaroni and cheese, frozen vegetables, tater tots, that kind of thing.
Mm.
I mean, the only thing that's where a little different is my mom used to make bread, so I would have, you know, homemade bread.
Oh, wow.
And I think it was in 86, my mother went to Italy for about a week-long trip with my uncle, who's a wine merchant. And when she came back, she went to Central Italy, Tuscany, Umbria, those places. She started cooking, you know, pretty much authentic Italian cuisine that she learned there.
Oh, wow.
Which, yeah, none of us had up to that point. So,
hey, so maybe that her trip changed your life.
I think it might have. That's when, yeah.
Amazing. So, and you graduated from CIA, the Culinary Institute of America, which mm-hmm. is also called the culinary equivalent of Harvard. So, how did you get into cooking in the first place?
I guess when I graduated high school, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I had a scholarship from IBM to do, I guess I could do whatever, but I ended up doing computer science in a small liberal arts school. And the food there was terrible. And I ended up, you know, you had to live on campus and you had to be on the meal plan. So I ended up, you know, after a couple of years, just, I don't remember quite how that. You had to do some kind of special justification to get off of all that. So ended up living in an apartment and just cooking. And then people would come over because, you know, I was cooking like Salisbury steak and fried rice and that kind of stuff. But it was, you know, it was, I think, better than what the school was serving. So so people were always coming over to have food. And that's the first time I was really cooking for people. And I think, you know, after I graduated, I decided maybe I'd use that degree for a little while at least, but I knew that that's probably really what I should have been doing the whole time. So after working for a little bit, I ended up, you know, going to the CIA and becoming a professional.
Interesting. So it sounds like a big part is entertaining, make people happy.
That's part of cooking, yeah. It's not just, you know, it's not just a laboratory. It's somebody has to eat that.
Right. And, but you eventually got interested in Japanese cuisine, right? Mm. So what happened?
That happened at the CIA. It didn't even cross my mind before I went, but you have to do an internship at the CIA.
Mm.
While you're there. And I ended up doing it in Japan. There's a restaurant in Tokyo called Kisho, shabu shabu and Japanese cuisine.
Mm.
So they were willing to do all the paperwork that was necessary for the school, which was, you know, really incredible on their part. And so I did an internship there. And then while I was there, I had a free month that I spent in Kyoto and got into Kikinoe, their second location in downtown Kyoto.
Oh, wow.
And did a what's called a stage there, you know, a free, you work for nothing. Mm. And maybe they give you some food or something like that.
So the CIA originally, I mean, it's a part of the program. They had a special relationship with the Kisho and Kikinoe.
They, I think it's either the son or the nephew of the owner of Kisho had gone to the CIA.
Oh.
You know, a lot of people around the world will send, you know, their heir or something to the CIA to get some training. It's you know, in addition to training professional chefs, it also trains, you know, people like that who won't become chefs. They'll go back and go into management or something like that.
Mm.
So I think that's where that connection came from. But you know, I ended up also training in Kikinoe while I was there, and that was, you know, Kisho was a great experience. Kikinoe was also a great experience, and I kind of thought, you know, maybe I want to do this with my career instead of just, you know, dabbling in it.
Mm, right. So so that's why you were able to get the job eventually at the Kikinoe?
Right. So I kind of got lucky with that, where I was, during my second year, after I'd come back from my internship at the CIA, I came down to the city and was dining at a restaurant called Upstairs at Boulay.
Mm.
It's not open anymore, but the sous chef there went on to be the chef at Brushstroke. I was dining there that night, and Farhan Adria of El Bulli was dining there that night, and Chef Murata of Kikinoe was also dining there that night, just completely coincidence. So I got my picture taken with Farhan Adria, and I went up to Chef Murata and I said, you know, I'm going to graduate soon. You think I can have a job? And he said, well, why don't you come back and train for another month and we'll see how it goes.
What a night.
And I said, all right. And so when I graduated, I got a plane ticket and went to Kyoto and stayed there a month and trained again for a month. And at the end of the month, I said to him, well, what do you think? Can I have a job? And he said, yeah, I guess, sure. Wow. He said it in Japanese. He goes like "ma eka"
in Kansai language dialect.
So, I came back to America, sold pretty much everything, sold my car, and packed a couple suitcases and went to Kyoto.
Yeah, well, the chef Yoshihiro Murata, he's really the figure to promote Japanese cuisine globally too.
Right.
And I think he just awarded the status of a person of cultural merit by the Japanese government.
Right, right.
So he's totally well-respected. I personally was lucky to be able to speak to him multiple times. And he's just a beyond great cook. And here he said he's a third generation. Mm-hmm. And his grandfather was the first. And he was more like, you know, beyond just in the kitchen. And his father was more like, you know, craftsmanship in the kitchen.
Right.
So it's like a generation skips, and he's really more of a promotion. That's his really interest of cooking.
Yeah, I think he saw me as being a part of that. You know, I didn't get into that restaurant because I was amazing at Japanese food or something. I got in the restaurant because I really wanted to, and you know, I was lucky enough that he wanted to have somebody in the restaurant that could then, you know, go and and spread that technique.
Kind of ambassador.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah.
Right. So I think you became one. And the Kikunoi, it's a very traditional Kyoto kitchen, but, you know, again, Murata-san's open-minded.
Mm-hmm.
But how is the kitchen culture? It's really like...
It took me longer to adapt to the work culture than it did to learn the language.
Out of 7 years, basically.
Yeah, I'd say it was about the third or fourth year that I started to get comfortable with the language. It wasn't until the fifth or sixth year that I was actually starting to get comfortable with being the kind of person that you're expected to be in that environment.
Wow. But you didn't speak Japanese before? When you
Not really. It. Just, you know, I could just say hello and goodbye and that kind of stuff.
Oh, wow. Wow. So, and how do you describe the kitchen culture?
So, I mean, all kitchens are hierarchical to some extent. And Japanese kitchens would be even more hierarchical. But... Kikunoi's kitchen, I didn't realize this when I went there, you know, I just thought that's what it was, is particularly hierarchical and particularly traditional in terms of its work culture. And it had changed when I went there. They did not allow corporal punishment starting a few years before I started, but they had it before then. Now it's actually a little bit different from when I was there too. I went back and visited, and it's, you know, it's a little sunnier now. it's very much, in an American kitchen, you have people that you have to answer to, sous chefs and chefs. And if you're a komi, you probably have to answer to a chef de partie or something like that also. But in Japan, in a traditional place like that, you answer to everybody who's senior to you. So there's 25 cooks in the kitchen. You have 24 bosses when you're the guy on the bottom. And you have to... So that's hard enough. But then after a year, they're going to hire new cooks. And it's not automatic that you now have a new job. Because now there are all these new cooks. You have to get... Like, they don't... The sous chef or the chef de cuisine is not tasking people. They're just... telling the line cooks what to do, and the line cooks are telling the prep cooks what to do. So you have to get these new kids who have just come in, who all want to be there to, you know, get on the line. They're ambitious. You have to get them to do what you're doing, which is basically cleaning all day.
Right.
And you get them to do that so that you can that you then have time to help the line cooks with what they're doing, so that then you can show that you have the competence to get on the line when it comes time to shift the positions around. Yes, you have to learn. It's hierarchical in both ways. You have to learn how to deal with people above you, but you also have to learn how to deal with people below you.
Because you have, say, like 24 bosses, right, the first year.
Right.
So you kind of learn all around what you have to do in the kitchen. And then you start managing in the second year. So it's kind of like fast track.
Yes, you learn leadership in a Japanese context really quickly there. And all those kids, they go through the same thing. And some of them do it well and some of them don't.
Mm.
But yeah.
Wow, that's kind of fascinating.
It's not what I expected. I was expecting some kind of monk-like, you know, experience. You work very long hours and you're dedicated. There's this whole social aspect that I didn't even cross my mind.
Wow, I didn't know that distinctive difference between Western and Japanese kitchen. Okay, so what was the biggest challenge in that environment?
Yeah, that was it. And like I said, it wasn't just dealing with the hierarchy above you, because, you know, you can kind of put up with getting yelled at. You learn how to deal with that, even if you don't think it's fair. And in Japan, you get yelled at, you apologize in front of the whole kitchen and bow. It was even harder to learn how to, you know, get the new cooks to do it. And it's something that I didn't even attempt the first few years. You know, I let my people who were the same level as me manage the younger cooks. I wasn't even attempting that. But I you know, people quit all the time because it's really strenuous. I got to the point where I had to be that person.
Right.
And then it ended up working out. Like, I actually have good relationships with my kohais to this day. But
wow. So, and also you had the language barrier at that point.
Yeah.
Wow. So, and then at the same time, what's the most rewarding experience there?
Well, I guess as far as the kitchen goes, things like, you know, realizing that you can actually do it. You know, you have a day where, you know, it was a challenging day and, you know, everything actually clicked. But I think even more rewarding for me was the kind of the extracurricular stuff. We would do it because it's such a traditional restaurant. You know, every year in Kyoto, there's a festival on the 31st of July. And this festival is particularly important to restaurants because there's a mountain. It's the highest mountain that surrounds Kyoto. It's called Mount Otago. There's a lot of Mount Otagos all over Japan, but this is Kyoto's Mount Otago.
Right.
And there's a temple to the fire god on the top of Mount Otago. And it's about a 4-kilometer trek up this mountain. It takes you, if you're really fast, you can get up there in an hour, but it takes most people a couple hours to get up there. And cooks from all over Kyoto are making this trek after work on the 31st, so 11 o'clock at night, and going up to the fire temple so that they can get a prayer written on a piece of paper from the priests that protects your restaurant from fire for a year. This is very important. Almost every restaurant in Kyoto has one of these pieces of paper stuck on the hood, you know, above the stove, above anything that they're using fire for, to protect the restaurant from fire. So, and you're at least at Kikino, you're supposed to do that 3 times altogether. And by my third time, now I'm leading these young cooks on, you know, going up and down the mountain. That's what I look back on as thinking, like, that was, yeah, I like that.
Interesting. Yeah, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's like a martial arts holistic kind of mindset.
I guess, right? Yeah.
It's like a focus. And also, I think, because Kyoto structures seem to be more wooden, and actually the risk of fire is still more imminent than other cities. So which month is 31st of which month?
July.
July, okay. I have to look up. Okay. And after spending 7 years in the Kikunoi, so you moved to Tokyo.
That's right.
Right? In 2014. So why did you cook in Tokyo and why did you leave?
Well, it had been 7 years at Kikunoi. I'd kind of reached a sort of, critical mass of ability where I felt like, I could have stayed there my whole life, you know. And there are people that do. When I started there, the executive chef had been there for 60 years.
Wow.
He went right out of junior high school. He started when he was 13, and he was 73.
Wow.
At that time. Mm. And he'd been there for 60 years. He worked for Chef Murata's father before.
Wow.
So, you know, and there's, as far as a chef, you know, being a chef and wanting to have something to do your career, you know, there's enough to do there. I mean, there's so much to, you know, it's the cuisine. There's so much depth of the cuisine.
Mm.
There's so much depth of the culture, ceramics, things like that. Like you could spend your whole life just exploring those depths.
Well, because I went to see their warehouse to store seasonal dishes.
Oh, yeah.
Because they have to change all the dishes from small to big.
Yes, yep.
Because it's seasonal. That's kind of sticky.
Yeah,
right?
Once a month, you're there till about 2 or 3 in the morning changing out all the dishes. Yeah.
It's crazy. Yeah. But, well, that's the whole tradition. And then, you know, I think it's really that the Kaiseki cuisine is a part of culture, right? To have that.
It's plugged into the culture.
Right. All right.
But I thought that, okay, I could spend my whole life here, but I think it's time to take what I've learned. And then I originally was going to come straight back to the United States, but I ended up kind of looking around and realizing that really in the United States, sushi is 90% of Japanese food in the United States.
Mm.
And, you know, for me, sushi was just, you know, and in Japan, sushi is just, you know, it's like pizza in Italian cuisine. It's you know, it's might be popular and widespread, but it's just the tip of the iceberg, you know. It's,
right. And the sushi also, it's edomai, means it's originating in Tokyo.
Edomai sushi did, yeah.
Yeah, because actually Murata-san one time said, you know, don't eat sushi in Kyoto. That's what you should eat in Tokyo.
If you're going to have a meal that's sushi, yeah, you should have it in Tokyo. Or actually recently Fukuoka is getting really good at like pure sushi. And then Kanazawa has had great pure sushi for a long time now.
Good ports. So.
Right. So, yeah, Kyoto is... There is sushi in Kyoto, but it's part of a meal or it's like a snack for lunch, traditionally speaking.
Right.
As far as making sushi a whole meal, and particularly a high-end meal, it's that started in Tokyo.
Mm, right. So in Tokyo,
right.
You went to work at Ginza Sushi. Okay.
That's right. Before that, I did work at a Kobe beef butcher in Ikebukuro called Nikusho Moriyasu.
Wow.
He had published a couple of volumes in Japanese on how to butcher beef.
Mm.
And my wife had those books, and I read them, and I thought, okay, I want to work for this guy a little bit. And I worked for him for a month, and at the end of the month, he said, you know, if you want to work here for a few years, you're welcome to.
Wow.
But if you're not going to work here for a few years, I need to hire somebody else. So, you know, you need to decide. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to go ahead and leave because I really want to do some sushi before I go back to the United States.
Right. But it sounds like you did first shabu-shabu and you did kaiseki. And you learned how to deal with this wagyu. So it's kind of like already that's pretty
well,
good coverage.
Yeah, but a shabu-shabu restaurant, you're getting in like a block of ribeye.
Uh-huh.
And you're putting it on a slicer.
Right.
You know, and that's how... You're not learning how to actually break down a Japanese, you know, a kudoke wagyu.
Right.
So, you know, at that butcher, you know, I worked in the back, you know, peeling tendons from primals.
Right.
And then I also got a chance to go to the central slaughterhouse. All the slaughtering in Japan is done by the government.
Mm.
And then there's wholesalers who get the sides and then sell the sides to retailers and hotels and restaurants. So I went to that slaughterhouse and saw the auction for the...
That should be fun.
And, you know, you have to wear, like, the special coat. They really... It's extremely clean and extremely well-organized.
Mm. Wagyu is really a big deal. So it's like, I wouldn't say craft beer, but, you know, it's like every region has different...
You feed them the craft beer.
That's true, too. Right. So, but how did you get the Ginza... You know, Sushi Aoki, that's really one of the best sushi places they say.
Yeah, that was not... It was not easy. Even after working at Kikunoe for 7 years, you know... and yeah, it was Michelin 3-star, but nobody really cares about that in Japan. But it was a famous restaurant in Japan, you know, regardless of Michelin.
Right.
But even then, no... You know, I got kind of the... You know, I knew a sushi chef... who had good connections. He had done a book called Edomai Sushi in English.
Mm.
And my wife and I had helped him write that book. and his name is Kikuo Shimizu-san. And he was kind of he was retired at that point, but he said, you know, I'll ask around and try to get you into some place. And then he came back to me and he said, you know, they said if you want to work like 10 or 20 years, sure, but if you just want to work for a few years, they don't think there's any reason, there's any point. And then the editor of Fujingoho magazine in Japan.
That's a very high-end, heavy, glossy magazine.
Right,
very
right.
Traditional.
Right. You know, heard about that I was, you know, that I was trying to find a sushi restaurant and started to help, ask around. And Chef Aoki is kind of like Chef Murata in that he's sort of, he has a traditional restaurant. He does his thing. He does it at a high level. But he also has a vision. Like he's always looking past, you know, what's right in front of him. And somehow he, you know, I got an introduction to him from this editor at Fujingoho. And he said, sure, you can stay here 2 to 3 years. I'll teach you as much as I can in that time.
Right. So that's Toshikazu Aoki.
That's right.
Right. And I heard he came to the States and was, like, spent a year or something.
He's been, so he's a marathon runner. Mm-hmm. And he's been to New York City to do the New York City Marathon on a couple occasions.
Wow.
And so he also did something in LA where he did like a little competition with an American sushi chef in LA that they televised or something like that. I don't know all the details, but and he likes to travel. He'll go to Hong Kong and so he, you know, he has his thing. He's doing his traditional edamame sushi, but he also you know, likes to at least think about other things.
Right. So kind of preserve the tradition but progress.
That's right. That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So so what did you learn at Sushi Aoki and Chef Aoki?
So I think most people when they go to a sushi restaurant, they, you know, they see the chef at the counter making the nigiri or the makimono or whatever, and they think that's the skill of sushi is, you know, you grab the fish in one hand, you grab the rice in the other hand, you maybe put some wasabi or some other fragrance or something in there. You form a piece of sushi and you serve it, and they think that's the skill of sushi making. That's like the last 2% of sushi making. The first 98% is getting in the fish, cleaning the fish, reading the quality of the fish, you know, not just how good it is, but how much fat is there. You know, was there a rainstorm that changed the salinity of the water and that changed the condition of the fish? And then, so based on that, you adjust how you salt and or vinegar and or age that fish. Then you have all the shellfish that all has its own skill. No fish you fillet quite the same way twice. So in Kaiseki, you know, Kyoto is far from the sea by Japanese standards. So you're dealing with a rather small range of fish in Kyoto in general, traditionally speaking. You know, you have tai, you have hamo, amadai,
right.
You know, guji. You know, maybe 5 or 10 fish that you're going to see all the time, ayu, that you're going to see all the time in Kyoto. In an edamame sushi restaurant, throughout the year, there's going to be, I don't know, 40 or 50 different kinds of seafood that you're going to deal with.
And all seasonal, too.
All seasonal. So, you know, 20, 30 kinds of fish, 20, 30 kinds of shellfish. They all have their own little quirks. And so you have to learn... And you have to do it with skill. You know, when the chef is at the counter and he picks up that piece of fish, everybody can see that piece of fish. If the way the fish was prepared is not perfectly clean, it's embarrassing for the chef. You know, and there are, some guests won't notice, but a lot of guests will. And they'll see the condition. They'll say, oh, okay, there's something wrong with what's going on in the back there. So, yeah, the first 98% of sushi is all of that. And also the rice, of course, you know.
Right.
Cleaning the rice, cooking it, you know, mixing it. So,
right, it's like a cake decorated at the end.
Exactly,
the cream
exactly,
topping, that kind of
exactly.
Thing.
Right. But I think even more because cakes. I mean, I don't know. People tend to not care how cake tastes.
That's
like
true.
You go to a wedding, and I don't know if it's ever any good.
Right.
But sushi, and it has to look good, but also has to taste good. And you know, there are so many little steps. There are so many little things you have to learn to get every one of those elements right.
Right. Isn't it exciting, though, for a chef? Because it's new ingredients and you have to really manage and master this thing. And once you do it, like, wow, I did it.
Yeah. I don't know. You never... Every once in a while, you have a good day where you're like, well, that actually worked out really well. Mm. But for the most part, there's always the next thing you have to, you know, tackle. And the whole time I was in Japan, I'm thinking, you know, I'm learning all this stuff. I am going back to America. I have to think, like, how what's applicable, you know? Mm. So it's like learning a body of technique, and then, you know, I always had that in the back of my mind. Mm. So, yeah, even when I left Sushi Aoki, it's okay, now's the time to actually apply this stuff.
Mm. Wow. Sounds like really precious, incomparable experience.
Yeah. I don't know. It was a series of events, I guess,
I don't know any other non-Japanese chefs. Like spending, well, after Kikunoi, of course, you totally kind of, you know, qualified for the opportunity, but I don't think it's easy to be in the position and actually maintain the job so long.
Yeah, there aren't even any Japanese chefs who do that.
Right.
Usually you train in Kaiseki, that's your career. Now you're going to go open like a couple, maybe open izakaya, you know, maybe open a Kaiseki restaurant. Maybe you'll go be the executive chef at a hotel that has a Kaiseki restaurant inside, something like that.
Mm.
But you're not going to go train in a sushi restaurant, start all over again, and then try to make, like, nobody does that.
Mm, maybe it's not the mindset either.
Right.
Right. So I think in a good way that you are, you know, not in the framework of Japanese cuisine. But so the Chef Aoki is known for being open-minded. So that's why I think he started a program called Project Blue Tree.
That's right.
In 2016.
That's
what
right.
is it?
That was coming from his desire to sort of see what else you could do with sushi as not just on its own, but as part of a meal. And so before he knew I was going to leave and come back to America, but before I did, he wanted to ask me to collaborate on this thing where I would do the kaiseki portion, he would do the sushi portion, and we would run it for a few months, and just, you know, as a kind of as a pop-up, like a sort of extended pop-up, I suppose.
Right. And of course, the collaboration between two chefs.
Right, right.
Right, showcasing.
I mean, in this case, it was very unequal. and then after we finished that with my portion, he went on and did another collaboration under Project Blue Tree with a Korean chef, and then also, I think, a fugu specialist.
Oh, wow. The blowfish.
Yes, poisonous blowfish specialist. So, and then, you know, having that as part of a sushi course, like a fixed menu that was included both sushi and that other element.
Interesting.
And what you can learn from putting those together.
Wow. I wish I could be at the dinner. Sounds really interesting. So what do you think about the future of Japanese cuisine based on your experience of being a part of that conservative community of sushi chefs or the kaiseki chefs, as well as working with more progressive chefs like, you know, Aoki-san?
That's an interesting question. If you mean the future Japanese cuisine in Japan, I think there's a lot more... I think right now a lot of the high-end is being driven by people coming from overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Which is good because it, you know, spreads authentic Japanese cuisine around. You know, they'll take it back and then they'll have new expectations where they are.
Mm.
But it does mean that, you know, in the past, the highest end restaurants were the ones that had, you know, particularly with kaiseki, that were most steeped in technique and tradition. And you had to show you can source the best ingredients. You have to show you know what to do with them. You know, you have to show you understand this, you know, this one obscure technique from 300 years ago. You know, you got to get that on the menu somewhere to kind of show that, you know, it's like you're showing that you have those chops. And the more you have guests coming from overseas and the more it's kind of Instagram driven, the more it becomes, you know, can we put caviar and truffles on things? You know, can we, or gold leaf, or, you know, this kind of thing. That element has always been there in both kaiseki and sushi. You know, it's always been luxurious, at least high-end sushi, and kaiseki has always been luxurious. But there's always been kind of a, you know, the way you judge a kaiseki chef is how well can you cook a turnip? You know, right. How well can you make a white miso soup? It's not how well can you, you know, put uni and truffles on wagyu. You know, that was never part of kaiseki before.
Right.
And it has become that around the world, and it's affecting things in Japan as well, because you have people who come from overseas are spending more than the Japanese are on the food. So that's driving the high-end market in Japan.
Right. So considering that kind of, you know, foreign influence or demand that could change the market, what do you think is the essence of Japanese cuisine that could stay regardless?
Well, I think it's sort of, I think you're going to have to, you know, you could argue like with French cuisine that you have to go to, say, Lyon to get real French cuisine. You're not going to get it in Paris. I think that will happen with Japanese cuisine. I think already you're not, I mean, with the exception of sushi, and I think even sushi is going to change, you're not going to get authentic Japanese cuisine in Tokyo over the next couple of decades. I think, and it would have been Kyoto, but I think Kyoto is going to go in that direction too. You have to find it somewhere else. You know, somewhere more obscure, somewhere that that people aren't going to, where you can find somebody who actually, you know, is connected with their, because all cuisine and Japanese cuisine is the same way. It's connected with where you are. And, you know, I think you're going to have to look harder in the future to find that.
Interesting.
I'm kind of lucky that I went at a time when, you know, even though, I mean, there was no Michelin guide for Kyoto when I went to Japan. It was in my third year, I think, that the first Michelin guide came out.
Okay.
So, you know, There were some people, you know, it was on some people's radar and people would travel there, but it wasn't like it is now.
Right. Well, that's interesting, right? That makes me think, like, you know, if you go back at the Edo period, the Portuguese influence spread and the cuisine changed. We had now tempura thanks to them.
Right.
And that kind of thing, like, in the big picture, all those things happening is part of a flow and tradition. It could be a part of tradition that's like, you know, big movement.
Right.
So yeah, that's interesting.
Something like tempura was something where they let the influence in for a moment and then it became part of the culture. And that's happened a lot in Japanese cuisine. So I guess we'll have to see how this is going forward. Is this, you know, influences that will come in for a period and then will be internalized and processed and made more, you know, go through that, you know, I think maybe that's the essence of Japanese cuisine, is that, you know, influences come in, but then they get morphed into this native aesthetic. You know, tempura doesn't resemble deep fried food anywhere else in the world. Certainly not Portuguese. So, you know, there is something that happens to influences that come into Japan.
Right. So adaptation and obsession, like these are the words always associated with anything else, I think.
And specialization and a respect for craftsmanship.
I don't think that's going to change.
I don't think so either. I hope not. God, I hope not. Yeah. But I can't imagine.
Right. I think all this, I don't know, like Shintoism, respect, you know, like a million gods in your life or the school education. As far as they remain the same, I think it's going to be there.
I think you're right.
Right. All right. So we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about Derek's Sushi Kaiseki menu at Shoji at 69 Leonard Street in New York. So please stay with us. Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. The knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com. Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese Broadcasting Live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Derek Wilcox, who studied Japanese kaiseki cuisine at the 3-star Kikunoi in Kyoto, and Edomae Sushi at the Ginza Sushi Aoki in Tokyo, also Michelin starred, for 10 years in total. And now he's a chef at Shoji at 69 Leonard Street. So again, you are now the chef at the Shoji at the 69 Leonard Street, New York, which earned 3-star New York Times rating. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
So what's the path to become the chef there?
So the owner of the space came to Tokyo to recruit a chef to come back and run it. Mm-hmm. And he got an introduction to Chef Aoki through Chef Shimizu, who had previously been a chef at 15 East here in the city. Right. And he's now in Bangkok.
Right.
And so he was friends with Chef Aoki. And so I think Chef Shimizu had suggested to the owner, why don't you go talk to Chef Aoki? He might be willing to do some collaboration, we'll see. And then I was translating, for that.
Right.
For that talk,
right.
Because I always had to do that kind of stuff there.
Mm.
The owner was, I don't think he thought that, that I would be, and then he kind of asked about me and then he found out, things that I'd done. Mm. And then he realized he came and ate at Sushi Aoki as well.
Mm.
And, all, the nigiri, of course, was done by Chef Aoki, but all the, I cooked the rice, there was a soup at the end, I cooked the soup at the end, all the preparation was done by me. I had done some nigiri at the, at the Project Blue Tree as well.
Mm.
But, when he tasted that, he's like, why don't I ask this guy to come back? why don't we do that? And Chef Aoki said, I think you should do it. I think you should go.
Mm.
I think it'd be a good experience. Be careful, but I think you should go. And
I like the be careful.
Yeah, no, he's not your typical image. I think most sushi chefs really aren't, but there's this image that sushi chefs are these grumpy old men and abusive and whatever. And he's not like that.
Mm.
But so I agreed and came back in August of 2017. And we didn't have a lot of time. We opened in September.
Mm.
After about a month, got some staff. We got really great supply from at that time, the Tsukiji Fish Market. It's moved, but opened. And the concept was to serve sushi and kind of kaiseki, sort of like a combination of tea kaiseki, which is an earlier, somewhat simpler version of kaiseki, and kappo, where it's traditional Japanese cooking but done in front of guests, at a counter. Going with that concept.
Mm. Kappo is really popular in Japan. We don't hear the word couple very often, that's very important.
It is, yeah.
It's almost like more involving communication with the chef, and you're part of cooking and dining.
Right, right.
So, that's exciting. And you have only 12 seats?
At most, yes.
Okay.
we flex a little bit based on, you know, if somebody does a buyout, we can do up to 13, but we will generally have somewhere between 8 and 10 seats per seating.
Right, yeah. Comfortable seating.
Right, right.
Right. And what does shoji mean?
So shoji started out as, so the restaurant was there, but it didn't have a chef. And so, and we started as a pop-up. I was thinking maybe 3 months, we'd do something for 3 months. The owners kind of convinced me to stay at least 6 months. Mm. So I thought, okay, we'll do 6 months. But then I thought he would hire, you know, another chef or something, and I would help transition, and then, you know, I'd go do something else. And we got such a response that, you know, it ended up continuing. And then, as far as the name, we were trying to come up with a name that meant, in this case, shoji originally was sukunai toki.
Mm.
So, you know, a moment.
Right, like limited time.
A fleeting time, right. Just a moment. Or it can also mean youth. The same characters in both Chinese and Korean tend to mean youth rather than a brief time.
Mm.
And it's not a common... It's not a common thing in Japan. It's something you'll find in a dictionary, but it's not like a common, you know, if you ask a Japanese person, what does shoji mean? They'll say, oh, that's the sliding screen door that, you know.
That's what I thought.
There's another kind of dictionary meaning for shoji, which is shou as an alternative reading for sei, meaning life, and ji meaning she, that's, you know, been altered to ji because it comes after another word, meaning death.
Right.
And it's the, in Buddhism, it's the native Japanese word for samsara, which is the cycle of life and death.
Right.
So that also seemed to be appropriate because it was kind of a rebirth.
Right.
So the owner really liked that.
So, me too.
So we ended up going with the name shoji. And then after we decided to actually make the restaurant permanent, this was before we got the New York Times review, but we were getting such good response from some very sophisticated diners in New York. And, you know, there's something I didn't expect is how, you know, just how sophisticated New Yorkers are when it comes to Japanese cuisine.
Right.
I don't think there's another city in the world, even in Hong Kong, I don't think is as up on Japanese cuisine as,
really?
As New Yorkers are.
That's amazing.
And just having this great response, we decided, well, why don't we maybe continue the restaurant, like make it a proper restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back to Japan, went to Kyoto, met with Chef Murata, and I was there with my wife, and my wife asked him to do the calligraphy for a shoji, because we wanted to have, you know, a calligraphy we could put on the door and maybe hang in the restaurant. And he said, he agreed to do it, but he said, you can't have this sukunai toki, you can't have your restaurant be named a little bit of time, because it's extremely bad luck.
Mm.
So, you know, you can keep the name shoji, we have to find other characters to represent that.
Huh.
So what he came up with is shou, which means like soar, as in, you know, like a dragon soaring, that kind of thing, or a bird soaring.
Mm-hmm.
And leaving ji is toki, meaning time. So... Mm. You could say it now means something like time to soar.
Right. So a lot of good, I think it's really contains the essence of Japanese culture and mindset. So it's kind of like ichigo ichie, you know, this time only. It's kind of like really positive thing. So, but you know, being, you know, you're an American chef, devoted your life to expressing more traditional form, Japanese cuisine, right? So, how do you call your cooking right now?
Oh, it's Japanese. I mean, it's you know, a lot of Japanese chefs do this. They will travel to France. They will travel to Italy. More recently, they'll travel to Spain. And then, you know, they'll spend 5 years, 10 years there. then they'll come back and open up a restaurant. Mm. And it's not exactly the same as French food that you'd get in France. In many ways, it's better, honestly. Same with the Italian food. Unreal Italian food in Japan. Mm. Just incredible. Some of the best dishes I've ever had have been at Italian restaurants in Japan. Mm. So that was my inspiration, you know. I'm an American going to Japan, you know, working there for 10 years, training, learning as much as I can, then come back and do something here. Right. And that serves two, like, first of all, it's showing just how much you can do with Japanese technique. You don't need, you can do fusion if you like. I don't think there's anything wrong with fusion, but you don't need it.
Right.
You know, if somebody gives you this ingredient and it, you know, and says, here, you need to make a dish from that, you have the technique to do something with that.
Right.
And I just, you know, just wanting to, so it is Japanese cuisine.
Right. Well, that's interesting. I really never thought that way, because people see Japanese cuisine as untouchable. Like, you know, if you're not Japanese, you can't. And then for Italian cuisine, for instance, the Italian immigrants came to the States.
That's ridiculous.
Right. And it totally makes sense, because I think you have an advantage too, because you see Japanese cuisine more objectively and maybe more analytically. So I think that's a big contribution that you're making to
I mean, maybe. There's nothing, you don't have to be Japanese to do Japanese food.
Not at all.
And, you know, when I trained at Kikinoe, those kids coming from all over the country, it was as new to them as it was to me. You know, that's not what you eat every day.
Right.
And it was as hard for them as it was for me. You know, people think like, oh, this American went to Japan, trained in the traditional kitchen. It must have been really hard.
Right.
Yes, it was. But it really wasn't any harder, you know, for me than it was for them. It's really, really hard.
Right.
On all of them.
Mm. And also, you know, you have a bigger reference point knowing other cuisine outside Japan. So,
the Japanese, they know other cuisines too.
Right,
so.
But you know, you get stuck in the kaiseki, you know, narrow window, then it's kind of like
you
are not allowed to go beyond that. But you naturally have it, so.
Yeah, there is a freedom here. So then the question is what you do with that freedom. Like then you're setting your boundaries yourself.
Right.
And where you set those boundaries is really important for your creativity.
Right. So what's your plan?
I would like to, with the rest of my career, accomplish a few things. I'd like to raise the bar for Japanese cuisine in the United States. I would like to provide opportunities for young American cooks who either want to make Japanese cuisine their career or just maybe learn it for a few years and then, you know, do something else. I'd like to provide them opportunities in the United States to do that. Which I didn't have when I...
Right. When you mean staging?
Staging, working. I mean, you can't... Mm. Staging is not... You're not going to go stage someplace for a month. You're going to see how some things are done. You're not going to learn how to do it yourself.
Right.
You're not going to learn the mechanics. You have to kind of cut through... There's a lot of marketing in Japanese cuisine. There's a lot of show.
Mm.
If you want to be a professional chef, you have to cut through the show and learn the mechanics.
Right.
And there was no opportunity to do that when I left cooking school. You could go to like a place like Nobu and Morimoto, which are great restaurants, but you know, it's not, and it's not really authentic Japanese cooking, you know, as it's practiced in Japan. So there really wasn't any opportunity for me. I had to go through everything I had to go through. I had to go to Kyoto and do that.
Right.
So that's the second thing. I want to provide opportunities for that
in
the United States. And then also do what I can to help people get connected in Japan so they can go to Japan for a month or two, which I think is very important. And then the third thing is ingredients in America. You know, if you want to open a French restaurant, you don't have to get everything from France. If you want to open an Italian restaurant, you don't have to get everything from Italy. It's ridiculous. Nobody would even think of that. But you want to open a Japanese cuisine restaurant, it, you know, at the very least, you're going to need to get things like soy sauce, sake, you know, from Japan, you know, seasonings. As far as raw ingredients, there's a lot of great fish in the sea here, but getting them out of the ocean and to the door of the restaurant is nowhere near as smooth and predictable mm-hmm. and reliable as it is in Japan. So I'd like to, I mean, that's a little bit more down the line, but I, you know, I don't know what I can do as a chef to help bring that about, but that's what I'd like to do.
That sounds great. That's all these things that everybody wanted to happen. So I know a few people, like, you know, I mean, like Yuji Haraguchi, who's also the one of Okonomi Osakana Museum. He does kind of like more foundational
right. stuff. Right. Like, I love Okonomi. Right. That's solid cooking going on there.
So I hope that kind of movement is going to be more mainstream.
Yeah.
So where can we find your updates?
Well, for now, I guess Instagram. I'm 88 Tamashii, TAMASHII. The number 88 and then TAMASHII, the two eyes at the end, on Instagram. And I'm going to get better about posting there.
Okay.
A lot of people complain to me I don't post enough.
Right.
And then, of course, you know, I'm at Shoji. Mm-hmm. So
that's 69 Leonard Street.
In Tribeca, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so the website is 69leonardstreet.com.
That's right. Although it's a very spare website.
Right. Just it's very minimalist.
Right, minimalist.
Right. Okay, but please keep me posted. And if you do something, you know, just doing the three plans you have, then we can come back and talk about them too.
All right. I'd love to.
Yeah, so thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Derek. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or at kikokatema.com. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. And our engineer is Matt Patterson. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.